Good morning and welcome back to Nach Yami. Today we start Daniel, Perek Bey, is the second chapter of the book of Daniel. This is a long Perek of 49 psukim, and we're going to look at it in small sections with a few points to ponder after each micro section. The general topic of the Perek is the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to see that this Perek looks very similar to Parshas Miketz in the Torah, in which the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, has a dream, and the Jewish interpreter, the Hebrew interpreter, Yosef, is able to penetrate the dream, which no one else is able to in the king's court, allowing him to ascend the ranks of Egyptian kingdom. We're going to see a very similar pattern here. Let's take a quick look at this. This starts off the first 13 psukim is about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Here's what it says. We're told that in the second year of the king Nebuchadnezzar, he had a dream, and he was very disturbed by this dream. He calls together all his sorcerers, all his soothsayers to interpret his dream, and they ask him to describe the dream, but he responds and says that they need to tell him what the dream is and its interpretation. He promises to destroy them if they don't tell him what the dream and the interpretation is, and great gifts for them and their family if they succeed. So they once again ask him to describe the dream, and once again he refuses to even give them what the dream is. He accuses them of being pretenders, of being fakes, if they cannot tell him what the dream is, and they respond in truth by saying there's no human being on dry land who could possibly know what you dreamed, O king. We can tell you perhaps what it means once you tell us, but we cannot tell you what you actually dreamed. It would have to come from another dimension, from Elohim, from a supernatural, spiritual dimension. And in response to that, Nebuchadnezzar, we get a sense of the type of character of person he is, says that he gets angry and he sends and slates all his advisors and wise soothsayers and stargazers to death. So he sentences everybody, including Daniel, including his friends, everybody is sentenced to death because they can't tell him the dream. Before we go further, let's just concentrate on a few points. We're told that the dating of this dream is in the second year of his reign. Now, this simply can't be for a number of reasons. First of all, at this point in time, it took 3 years of initiation of Daniel and his friends to be in the court of the king for them to even be part of this. And so also, the whole time that he captured Daniel really took place later on. The king Nebuchadnezzar became king in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, and it was quite a while until everything was underway. So the Mephoroshim explained that, but Ezra says, most of the Mephoroshim follow this, that this is actually the second year upon the conquest of Yerushalayim, the dominion over the Middle East. And it is at this point, says the Ibn Ezra, that he starts thinking about the future. Now that he's not concerned about the immediate battle, he starts thinking what is the future going to hold, and that's why his dream appears now. You'll notice, you look at the actual text itself, it says, it calls it chalomois, dreams, plural. Why dreams? So the Pirush Ibn Yechia explains that he dreamed the dream and its resolution. He dreamed both. The Rambam says it was because it left a heavy impression upon him, to the degree that Taipoya Merucha means to say that when a person has a prophetic dream, not simply a bad dream, their entire frame shakes. Their entire frame is hurting from this experience. You'll notice, by the way, that in this Perek, there is a switch to Aramaic. And this actually happens in the Pasuk Dalet, Vaydabruch HaKastim LaMelech Aramis, and the Kastim spoke to the king in Aramaic, and from then onwards, for the next little while in the Sefer, all of the words in the Sefer are going to be in Aramaic. It's worthwhile for those who have spent time learning Gemara to try to work out in Aramaic, but if those who are not, it's worthwhile. There are Hebrew translations and English translations of the Aramaic, but it's always worthwhile, again, when studying this, to try to understand what the Aramaic is saying itself. Aramaic is very similar to Hebrew. Why is there this switch to Aramaic? So obviously this is the language that they were talking at the time in Babylon, but there might be more than this. So the Mitzuras, David points out that this was the lingua franca, and they wanted everyone to know what an illegitimate request the king was making. The king was asking them not just to tell an interpretation of the dream, but what the dream was, but they had no way of getting inside of his head. So what they did was they spoke in a way that the entire court would be able to understand, so that everybody would understand how unreasonable it was. It didn't help them because they were still slated for death. The Malbim says it's the opposite. Remember that the court is filled of many wise people, and it seems that in the Babylonian foreign policy, one of the policies is to take the members or exilees of various cultures, like Daniel and his friends, and to bring them into his inner circle. And in order to do this, and thereby doing this, we have now a mixed audience. So what Nebuchadnezzar is doing, in a certain sense, is putting them on an even playing field. And the Chaldeans, the custom feel that they don't want to be on an even playing field. So what they do is they say to him in Aramaic, emphasizing their uniqueness and perhaps their xenophobia for those on the outside as well. One question which we should be asking ourselves is, why doesn't he? So why does he not tell them what the dream is? What's the big deal? So the Malbim explains that initially they thought it was because it was a bad dream, and he didn't want them to interpret it badly, because it perhaps, as a dream which is open to interpretation, as it is interpreted, it can actually mean it. So that's what they thought initially, which is why they pushed back. But the truth was not that at all. The truth was he had the dream and interpretation, but then it was taken. Both were taken from him. So he knew he had this terrible experience. He knew he had this prophetic experience, but he had no way of accessing it. So he needed them to help him in this way, which, as they correctly pointed out, no human being could really do. So at this point in time, we have the next section, Psukim Yud Dalet, to test Zion, in which Daniel intercedes. Daniel is slated for destruction. He goes over to Arioch. Arioch seems to be the officer in charge of death row, and he turns to them and he asks him, what's going on over here? Why they're all being killed? And he begs Arioch for a little bit of time, to ask the king for a little bit of time to interpret the dream. Which is strange, because just a point to ponder over here is, if Daniel was slated for destruction, surely he would have known about this, or it wouldn't be fair that he'd be slated for the same death row. And if he knew about it, then why is he asking about it? So Malbim explains, it's very clever. Daniel, when he heard about this whole business that was going on, he decided it was too risky to throw his hat into the ring. So he kept silent. He did not submit a suggestion to the king. But he was swept up in the decree of the king to kill the entire staff of advisors. And at which point, if you're to now say he needed more time, the people would say to him, well, why was it that you didn't say anything earlier? So he pretended he hadn't heard. He pretended that he was excluded from the conversation. He asks innocently to Arioch what's going on. When Arioch explains, and he says, please, can I have time? Which buys him a little bit of time to perhaps do what he's about to do. This leads us to the third section, where he prays to Hashem. Psukim Yud Zayin to Chof Gimel, very, very beautiful description. He goes home, he talks to Michananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his contemporaries, and he tells them what's going on. He turns to Hashem and he begs for mercy to show the secret to him and to his friends, so that he should be able to save himself, his friends, and all the Chachamim. Remember, he's praying for advisors who are potentially on the cabinet of Nebuchadnezzar, who had advised the destruction of Yerushalayim, unless he prays for them as human beings. At night, he gets a vision from Hashem, and reveals the secret to him. In the morning, he doesn't just get up and go. He spends the time to pray again to Hashem, to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu and bless him for being in charge of wisdom, being infinite beyond all time, establishing kings, removing kings, and giving wise to the wisdom to the wise. There's so many beautiful phrases in these prayers. As an example, Gola Amikta in Pasuk Chaf Beis, Hashem reveals that which is hidden and is deep, so that he prays, thanks Hashem. It's important to remember, we praise Hashem, we daven to Hashem when we need things, we also daven to Hashem when we receive things. That's what we see from these two prayers of Daniel. When he mentions this, just one point to ponder is, he talks about this notion of Hashem establishing and removing kings and being in charge of kings. Why does he mention this? It's not just because he's saying that Hashem is all-powerful. It's because the actual dream he has now got the secret to actually refers to the very notion of the removal of kings, which we're about to see. And that's what Rashi points out. We now move to the fourth section, which is really one pasuk, in which he returns to Arioch. And he turns to Arioch and he says, please don't kill the wise men. And he requests an audience with the king, which is strange, because how could you override the king's decree? And the king just said, kill these people. How can a underling say, God possibly say to the officer, not to kill them? So the Malbim explains that his concern was that while he's having an audience with the king, in the meantime, they're going to start sending her into the electric chair. So the problem is that he says, maybe don't kill him in the meantime, I'll take the responsibility. And therefore he allows Arioch to present him in a way that, were things to go sour, it would not be Arioch's doing. That's what he does in order to save the other sorcerers. Even though it's not his own skin, he's concerned for the skin of the others. So he comes in, and now we're just going to do the dream and the vision and the dream, vision, and interpretation, just very briefly. So Arioch rushes him in, and he says that I have this Judean refugee who's one of your advisors, and he says he has a solution. The king asks Daniel, he says, so do you know what the answer is. Daniel says, you know, he says, it's actually, by the way, his name was not Daniel, to the king, his name was Belshazzar. So the king said, Belshazzar, do you know what the answer is? And he says, no, I'm sorry. No human being knows the answer. It is only because I was able to access the divine, the words of Elohim from the divine king, Kosh Baruch Hu, gave me the answer to this. And he explains that because the king was concerned about his future, his thoughts went up at night and Hashem responded by giving him this dream. And here's what he describes the dream as. Remember, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar knows he had this dream. He can sort of remember, but he can't really remember it. So this is now all ringing a bell as he hears it. He describes that in the dream, there was a huge image, a huge statue, tremendous and terrifying statue. And this is what it was made of. Its head was gold, its chest and arms were silver, its abdomen and thighs were copper, its feet were a mixture of iron and clay. Then a stone, not quarried by the human hands, arrives out of nowhere and hits the iron and clay of the base, and the base crumbles, and everything turns into chaff and spreads, and the wind blows it everywhere and disappears. And that stone becomes a mountain and covers the entire land. That's the dream. Daniel then launches into the interpretation from Sukkim Lamed Zion to Mem Gimel, in which he describes four kingdoms. He says, you are the king of kings. Ant Malcho Melech Malchayo, he says to Nebuchadnezzar. You're the most powerful man. All living creatures pay credence to you. You are the golden head. Then after you will come a lower kingdom. That's the silver. Then after you will come a copper kingdom, which will control all the land. To Shalit, that will control over all of the land. Then there will come a much harsher kingdom, a kingdom made of iron and clay, which will cut up the people. And it's a mixture. Some of the toes of the feet will be iron, some will be clay. There will be mixed areas, but it will all be broken. And some will be broken, some will be strong, until it's completely destroyed. Before we go further, just at this point in time, who are these kingdoms? So it's interesting, he does identify the first of the kingdoms as Babylon, and he's going to identify the four kingdoms later on in the book of Daniel. But right now, he doesn't actually say who they are. The Mepharshim explain, silver is Persia, copper is Greece, and iron and clay is a dispute. The Rambam of Sajagon says this refers to Rome, the last kingdom to destroy the Beis HaMikdash and to have world dominion in this respect. However, Ibn Ezra says, if that's true, you'd be ignoring one of the greatest empires that has subjugated the nation of Israel in history, and that is Islam, the Arab kingdom. And so the Ibn Ezra says the Rome is actually rolled into Greece. It is a daughter of Greece. It is really the Arab empire that is being described, the kingdom of Islam, which is being described as the fourth kingdom. Now, Rabban El says that no, Christianity and Islam are subsidiaries of the kingdom of Rome. Just interesting way of describing this. What is the clay and the iron of the bottom of the feet? The Malbim explains this is a vision of Christianity and Islam, which are subsumed in Rome. So some of them are strong, some of them are weak, but they form this fourth empire. Could also refer to the split of the Roman Empire into the Byzantine Empire, the East and the West, after the fall of the Roman Empire. Be it as it may, then he turns to the last part of the interpretation and he describes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will establish the kingdom of heaven upon earth. This refers to the stone which is not quarried by the hands of man, which will express Hashem's kingdom, which will destroy all the other kingdoms and remain forever. Points to ponder is, why would Hashem show such a dream to Nebuchadnezzar? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is not looking for this, is he? So Babanel explains this is to demonstrate to Nebuchadnezzar, who had destroyed Jerusalem, that it was not by force that HaKadosh Baruch Hu rules, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu rules everything inside and out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could depose any of the most powerful kingdoms. That's what he's trying to display. The Chidai, in a similar notion, says in the Chumash Tanach, over here at the end of the parak, that it refers to the idea that although it's true that they destroyed Yerushalayim, but that was not because they destroyed Yerushalayim, but rather because HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed Yerushalayim to be destroyed and found a messenger, and you were that messenger, Nebuchadnezzar, to it. So it's putting him back in his place. How does this end? So the last few psukim of the parak describe Nebuchadnezzar's response, psukim memvov to memtes, 46 to 49. And in this section over here, Nebuchadnezzar prostrates himself in front of Daniel, and he brings offerings to Daniel, and he says, he recognizes that Daniel, in fact, represents the God of all gods, the power of all powers, and he promotes Daniel to be the highest office in the land of Babylon, and in which Daniel responds by the promotion of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who in turn are established in the gate of the king. Why does he offer Daniel a mincha? Why is he giving him a offering. So the Malbim explains this because he understands that Daniel has access to the divine. He feels that Daniel is a human expression of the divine and actually turns him into a deity himself. Daniel obviously turns this down, but it's interesting in the Mefarshim they point out that Daniel does not turn down the prostration, and for that he is going to be punished, as you're going to see later on, in terms of the lion's den. This sets up this perek. It is a remarkable perek in all accounts. It's also remarkable the most powerful, arrogant, and harsh human being is humbled to such a point, but it still lays the groundwork for the next part of the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.